In a surprise announcement late yesterday, Republican Congressman Tom Latham of Iowa's 3rd District said he'll retire after his term ends. And that turns the race for a key Iowa seat into a toss-up. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dennis Goldford at Drake University will be with us for the entire hour to talk not only about the significance of Latham's retirement, but also a look back at the year in politics that was. Edward Snowden and NSA surveillance, the split within the GOP, gridlock, Capitol Hill, government shutdown, and the catastrophic rollout of Obamacare. What do you think was the most significant political event of 2013? Join us for Politics Day with Dennis Goldford after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day has arrived on this 18th day of December. Joining me for the entire hour, by and large, to dissect 2013, the year that was in politics, Dennis Goldford in our Des Moines studio, professor of politics at Drake University. Dennis, good afternoon. It seems like we were talking politics together just hours ago.
That's what it seems.
Dennis and I together last night in downtown Des Moines at the venue at Court Center for a wonderful evening with NPR's political correspondent, national political correspondent Don Gagne. And if you'd like to hear somewhat edited version of that and find out what Dennis Goldford's unique role in the evening was, you'll have to tune in tomorrow to River during this time to hear that live conversation that took place last night in Des Moines. Dennis Goldford, I put forth that we look back at 2013 this hour after we talk about the breaking news that actually happened while we were in the hall last night getting ready talk with Don Gagne and welcome the audience of 150 or 200 people there last night. Late yesterday, in a surprise announcement, Republican U.S. Representative Tom Latham said he will step down from Congress after his term ends. And this turns that race for a key seat into a toss-up, right, Dennis?
I think so. We could probably move that race from what perhaps would have been leaning Republican in 2014 to a toss-up. That really was a stunning announcement because Congressman Latham has just gone through, really, other than a person's second election after he's been elected to Congress the first time, that sophomore reelection is always a tough election to get through. If you can, you tend to do pretty well afterwards. But the other kind of tough election for a member of the House is when the playing field gets changed. And that, of course, is redistricting stemming from reapportionment. So like several other representatives, all of them, I guess, in the state, everybody had a new district drawn. And Congressman Latham, like the other three representatives, had to fight an election on relatively new territory. And so he went to all that work and he did it, and he did it successfully, defeating Leonard Boswell. And having done it once, it seems he's ready to step down. So it really was a stunning decision to hear about.
Do you care to speculate, Dennis, as to why he may have decided to retire now, right after winning that redistricting election?
Well, you know, we'd have to go talk to Congressman Latham himself. It's hard to speculate. But broadly speaking, I think so far there have been, I think it's 9 members of the House who've decided to retire, 8 of whom, interestingly, are Republican. The only Democrat so far is Congressman Matheson from Utah, who is in a very red district. And so that will very likely be a Republican pickup. But even if you're a member of the majority party in Congress, and in this case in the House now, it's not a lot of fun anymore. It's nasty. It's bitter, as we've seen, and we've seen that all this past year, even though President Obama got reelected. It's hard to have a feeling of accomplishment. And Congressman Latham is well-respected. He's more or less in the middle in terms of seniority in Congress, in the House. He has a business background. I'm sure he was used to getting things done in that particular environment. And he's ready just to say, I'm through with the House.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the future of the 3rd District, reapportioned a district that includes now Des Moines, Council Bluffs, the southwest corner of the state of Iowa. Tell us about the makeup of the third. Does it lean slightly Republican?
If so, it's really because of independence. I don't know the, at least I don't have that with me, the breakdown of Republicans, Democrats, and independents, but I will note that I believe there are 16 counties in the 3rd District. At the time of reapportionment, you know, there are estimates about census all the time, but in terms of total population, when you have reapportionment, every district in the state and hopefully in the country is supposed to have exactly the same population. On the principle of one person, one vote. And so the estimate in for the after 2010 for the reapportionment that first hit in 2012 was that every district would have roughly 710,000 people. Even if we say the Des Moines metro area has grown by maybe 10, let's say roughly 720,000 people in the district, but about 434,000 of them are in Polk County itself. And about 99,000 in Pottawatomie. And so the rest are scattered around the other 13 counties in the district. So if you're a Democrat, while Polk County isn't as strongly and uniformly Democratic as it used to be, it's a good base of support for Democrats, which is, I think, what makes this move from leaning Republican to a toss-up. But, of course, it always depends upon who the other person running is. Everybody does well against, you know, candidate X, but when you put a name and a face into that X spot, then it changes things slightly.
We have to remind ourselves, Tom Latham beat incumbent Congressman Leonard Boswell in 2012 by nearly 9 points, but President Obama carried that district by 4 points. Let's talk about who may be interested in taking that now open seat in the 3rd District in each party. The Democrats?
Well, Stacey Apple has already indicated some interest in running as the Democratic nominee. It's hard to say at this point whether she'll garner some more primary opposition because of its being an open seat. We remember that however a district may lean, although, you know, in certain real red states or blue states, the district may be pretty uniformly red or blue, that is Republican or Democratic, even if it's an open seat. But if you're going to challenge for a seat in Congress, it's a lot easier, or shall we say less difficult, to run for an open seat, and that encourages more people to come out. So, you know, Stacey Apple's a candidate at this point. We'll have to see if any other Democrats come out. On the Republican side, this sort of changes the field a little bit because we have a whole host of Republicans running for the nomination to run against Bruce Braley for the Harkin seat in the Senate. It's possible, although at this point a couple of likely ones seem to be saying no, but it's possible that some of those who live in Polk County or at least in the district might decide they'd have a better shot running for the House seat than the Senate seat. You think of somebody like Matt Whitaker, for one, or David Young, Senator Grassley's legislative aide, some others, you know, they could decide that they do want to run for that Senate seat, but they could also decide that maybe they try their hand for the House seat.
And we're hearing also reports from Radio Iowa. We'll hear a longer report at the bottom of the hour, Dennis, Republican Matt Schultz, the current Secretary of State, grew up in Polk County. Lived in Dallas County. So he's got a strong footing there, and he is quoted as saying, "I am strongly considering it."
That's interesting. Secretary of the State is not the most visible position, but it's a very important position. It's supposed to be a kind of, even though you run as a member of a party, what your functions are supposed to be nonpartisan. You know, they set up wonderful databases for those of us who want to look at election results and voter registrations and things like that. But that would be an interesting move for Secretary Schultz when you consider that while it's not the most visible position in the world, he's won a statewide race. And it's always hard to make that jump from a local race or a local context to running at a statewide level. I mean, even Stephen King thought about that in terms of running for the Harkin seat. You know, you've got your more localized base, in his case, a congressional district. It's harder to make that jump to the statewide platform. If Matt Schultz were to run for this seat, he may be interested in the House, but in a way he would sacrifice a certain kind of name recognition and familiarity on the part of people for him on a statewide basis.
Mm-hmm. If he would run for that office, when we think of Matt Schultz, those of us keeping up on Iowa politics, instantly will have terms like voter ID, voter fraud come to mind. Does that do him good? If should he take this race on?
It would do him good with people who are already likely to support him, Republicans, conservatives, Tea Party activists, and so forth. It wouldn't do him very good, much good, with people who would be opposed to or prone to oppose him, Democrats, liberals, people like that. He would have to deal on the campaign trail, as he would if he ran for re-election as Secretary of State, with the fact that there, for all the effort, there's been relatively little outcome in terms of actual prosecutions for any kind of voter fraud. You know, the claim has been he's conjuring up a problem where none exists. That's what the opponents say. So he'd have to answer questions like that.
And lastly, as before we move on to a look back at the year, Dennis Goldford, Tom Latham, in his retirement, we must note he is a close friend of the U.S. House Speaker, John Boehner. I've been reading some speculation on the Hill that Boehner may retire. Do you see that as likely?
I don't think so. I believe I saw something in the press that he's filed for running again. It might be that he'd want another term and then maybe decide to retire after the next presidential election, or at least not run again in 16. I don't know. But he's been in a pretty tough situation. The caucus has been a very fractionalized caucus, the Republican caucus in the House. He's been trying to lead, and people have started calling Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz, over on the other side of the Capitol building. They started calling him Speaker Cruz. In other words, who was really running the Republicans in the House? So he's had a tough time, but he may want to go out feeling that he's going out on a winning hand rather than a losing or a difficult hand. So as of this point, at least, he seems to have filed for reelection, but even that can change.
So this is interesting. We have the announced retirement of Tom Latham, the other Tom, long time serving Iowa. Tom Harkin, 29 years as a U.S. senator, announced his retirement not too long ago. So we're seeing a shift in Iowa politics and a shift away from, our presence in Washington with veteran representatives, aren't we?
Yeah, it becomes a much more interesting year in Iowa. 14 will be interesting because, of course, we've got the governor's race, the race to fill the Harkin seat, the race to fill the Braley seat, now the race to fill the Latham seat. And, of course, incumbents Loebsack and King are still running for their seats in the House. We've got the question of control of the Iowa Senate, where the Democrats still have a 26-24 margin. And at stake in the Iowa Senate is among other things, certainly of interest to conservative Republicans, it's the possibility of a constitutional amendment to overcome the Varnum same-sex marriage decision. So that will be another heated race. So we will be as busy in the state of Iowa in 2014 as we seem to be during caucus and presidential year that we'll see in 2016.
Dennis Goldford, our guest this week, flying solo. Professor of Politics at Drake University, flying solo along with me in the sidecar, or what? I don't know what type of plane or vehicle we're in, actually, Dennis, but getting my imagery mixed up. We want to talk now about a look back at 2013, the year that was in politics. I want to reach out to you, our listeners. What do you think was the most significant political event of 2013? Tell us what impressed you. What do you think changed our political landscape the most? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or email, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find us on Facebook. What do you think is the most significant political event of 2013? Well, I'm taking my cues from the Atlantic Online for some of the areas that I'm going to, but I think a lot of this is not going to be disputed here. Dennis, remind ourselves how we started the year. We had Congress, and in the wake of that tragedy at Sandy Hook, we had Republicans and Democrats seeming to be finding common ground on gun control. Also on the agenda, the long-awaited immigration reform. This is the beginning of 2013. We had a triumphant President Obama winning re-election and looking toward the inaction of his signature health care law later in the year. Now, as 2013 closes, quite a different picture. One of the least productive years in Congress on Capitol Hill. And tell us, Dennis, What do you see as perhaps not the major, but one of the most major developments politically in 2013?
Well, there are any one of a number of things, but I think what's interesting to me, of course, is the politics of everything, particularly the conflict within the Republican Party and the stature of President Obama. It's interesting in regard to the first point that really the Democrats struggled for quite a number of years after Ronald Reagan to define themselves in a post-Reagan era because President Reagan was a transformational president who shifted the political terrain. And it was hard to be an old-line Democrat after the Reagan years. This is why you got complaints from Howard Dean, for example, in 2004, who thought the Democrats had become too corporatist and too conservative. But it was the Democrats struggling to define themselves in the post-Reagan years. But really, it's Republicans now trying to define themselves during the Obama years. So they're, I know I've said on the program before, you know, when a party sustains a series of electoral defeats, there are three reasons it can give, one of which it never gives. The first reason is, well, we lost these elections because we didn't get our message out or because our messenger wasn't very good. And Republicans certainly said that about McCain in 08 and about Romney in 12. And when they talk about outreach to various groups, they're saying they're not going to change policies, as Don Gagne, of course, indicated at the session we had. They're going to try to package them differently. That's a version of saying we didn't get our message out. The second reason is the one that they won't give, any party won't give. They could say, well, the public heard our message quite well. They just rejected it. No party's going to say that. You may as well go home if you're going to say that. So what, in this case, the Republicans have done, other than focusing on the first reason, is to go to the third, which is we lost because we weren't conservative enough.
Mm-hmm. But we did, just to interrupt here, sure. We did in March by the GOP, they had a committee of insiders convened by the Republican National Committee, and wasn't the urging there to pass immigration reform based on the Hispanic vote in 2012, soften rhetoric towards gays and minorities? Did any of that take effect?
No, it's been ignored basically because remember that if we had parties that were really national parties, which we don't, you'd have a party office or you'd have an office for each party in Washington and they would decide who would run from the various districts. So there'd be some kind of central control the way you'd find in Parliament or in the British parliamentary system over there with the Tories and the Labour and the Liberal Democrats and so forth over there. Here, it's all out on the hustings. So the people in Washington may make these claims about what the party want to do, but, you know, it's a question, for example, of what do the voters in Steve King's district want to hear? What do the voters in Bruce Braley's district want to hear? And so forth. So there's been lip service to that among Republicans, but again, there's been under the pressure of the Tea Party folks who really believe that the Republicans have been too moderate. They think, again, there's this great conservative majority out there in the country. If we just awaken them by nominating the right candidates who will give the right message, we'll sweep to power. So they're refusing to, at least so far, to go down that road that you mentioned.
And the moderates in the party reply that when you bring up the name Ronald Reagan, he wouldn't even pass their sniff test, would he?
That's right. That's right. I mean, everybody worships at the altar of St. Ronald of Reagan, so to speak. I mean, he's the figure. But, you know, you've got a lot of people saying that, you know, when the Republicans before the 2010 election proposed having a 10-point list of issues and to get money from the National Committee, you had to be right on at least correct on at least 8 of the 10, they said Ronald Reagan would have failed that test. So you do have some Republicans and conservatives now saying Reagan was great, but we need, in their view, Republican and conservative solutions for the 20-teens, not for the 1980s. And we'll see if that develops.
Let's listen to a bit of this, a remarkable press conference while we're on this specific topic of the GOP, the split within the party. Last week, Speaker John Boehner pushed back against the Tea Party wing in the Republican Party when he spoke at a press conference. Let's hear this remarkable excerpt.
These groups are using your members, using the American people. What do you mean by that?
Well, frankly, I think they're misleading their followers. I think they're pushing our members in places where they don't want to be. And frankly, I just think that they've lost all credibility. You know, well, they pushed us into this fight to defund Obamacare and to shut down the government. Most of you know, my members know, that wasn't exactly the strategy that I had in mind. But if you'll recall, the day before the government reopened, one of the people at one of these groups stood up and said, well, we never really thought it would work. Are you kidding me? Listen, you all know me, all right? I say what I mean what I say. I'm as conservative as anybody around this place. And all the things that we've done over the 3 years that I've been speaker have not violated any conservative principle, not once.
John Boehner in that press conference last week. I think I'm going to nominate, if it has a top quote of the year, top audio of the year from a journalist. Are you kidding me? Why did Boehner come out at this point and come out in the open with things that had undoubtedly been long spoken behind closed doors?
I think partly the frustration builds up, and partly it's an attempt to push back, but against what exactly? We talk about, say, the establishment versus the Tea Party folks. That's one way of characterizing it. But increasingly, under the impact of Citizens United, which authorized all sorts of outside groups to make contributions to campaigns and to advertise and so forth, we had traditionally the channeling of political conflict and disagreement through political parties. They were the two pipelines or the two venues that dealt with politics. But with the rise of these other kinds of actors enabled by the Citizens United decision and the spending and raising of all this other money, increasingly you've got these outside groups having a role directly inside the political process. And if you're a member of a political party, you know, it's like riding the tiger. It's easy to get on, but it's awfully difficult to get off. And they've made life for regular politicians trying to practice their trade, for which the art of compromise is the key thing on both sides. They've made life for them very difficult, and Boehner's been very frustrated.
About a minute before the break, on this point, the GOP, the divide within the party, how do you see this developing in 2014?
Well, in 2014, structurally, these midterms favor Republicans and the most conservative Republicans, as we saw in 2010, because Democrats tend not to vote as much as they do during a presidential year. So that will strengthen those folks. I think the real crunch will come with the presidential nomination for 2016.
Mm-hmm. For 2016. And you mentioned we don't have national parties. What do you mean by that?
Our parties are organized, mostly regulated. They've given their responsibilities on a state-by-state level. I mean, you see that when somebody who's not a Republican or Democrat, like Ross Perot 20 years ago, when a third party wants to get on the ballot nationwide, you don't go to Washington to do that. You've got to go state-by-state with petitions to get on each state's ballot, whereas all the states have automatic positions for Republicans and Democrats. So the system is stacked really against a third party.
Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of politics at Drake University, on this Politics Wednesday here on River to River. When we come back, we'll continue looking at the biggest political stories of 2013, including the Edward Snowden, NSA surveillance, that whole thing there, many facets of that, the government shutdown we haven't talked about, the rollout of Obamacare. We will remember that in 2013 as well. Also, when we come back, we'll get the Washington Post's Pinocchio list, the list of the biggest Pinocchios in the political world for the year. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Back with more Politics Day in just a moment.
Support comes from Lansing Funeral and Cremation Services, providing pre-planning options to meet individual needs. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Services, the tradition of our family serving your family, with two locations in Iowa City and Coralville, online at lansingfuneral.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's Politics Day. Ben Kiefer with Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University. And we're looking back at 2013 after looking at the breaking news that we had late yesterday that Representative Tom Latham of Iowa's 3rd District will finish up his current term and then call it quits. Says he's not running for anything else as well, which changes the political landscape earlier in the year. In January, we had the announcement by Senator Tom Harkin that he would not seek re-election either. Dennis Goldford and I were at an event last night, and tomorrow at this time you can hear our conversation with Don Gagne of NPR, national political correspondent. We'll be talking about some insider stories from Don Gagne about covering not only the campaign by then-Senator Obama, but also covering the White House with President Obama and covering the White House with George W. Bush. Tomorrow at this time, tune in for Politics and a Pint, recorded last night at the venue at in downtown Des Moines. One of the big topics, the big revelations of the year, Dennis Goldford, NSA contractor Edward Snowden, left an uncomfortable, well, left actually a comfortable life in Hawaii in May, went to a Hong Kong hotel room and turned thousands of classified documents over to journalists, blew the whistle on a global system of mass surveillance that is still making headlines. And as we are in the holiday season, I guess we can say these are revelations that keep on giving, aren't they, Dennis?
They sure are. It seems to be one thing after another. But you know what the broad problem is? When 9/11 occurred, there was certainly a set of investigations. How come we didn't know about this? How come we didn't do anything to prevent it? There was some suggestion that the Clinton people and certainly the Bush people should have been on top of the game to know enough to prevent that. But that didn't really rise to the level of any kind of firestorm or anything like that. It was basically one of these things that just happened, and we did the best we could. A second 9/11 would be the firestorm. No administration wants to preside over a second 9/11. And so you've got all of these policies instituted in order to prevent that from happening. Now, do they transgress constitutional limits? A federal judge just the other day suggested that they may well do that. That'll be appealed. But everybody's a little bit concerned about whether somebody's listening when we get on our cell phones or on our computers.
Including the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, as
That's
we
right.
heard out. And that has an impact on some of our closest allies in Europe.
That's right. I think the French Napoleonic diplomat Talleyrand, if I recall correctly, famously said about some particular issue that occurred, Napoleon, I think, or somebody had done something, and his famous phrase was, it was worse than a crime, it was a mistake. And, you know, in that particular case, say, bugging the phone of Chancellor Merkel, if not a crime, was certainly a mistake. It's not something you want to do to our allies, even though all of our allies pretty much know that everybody wants to know what everybody else is doing and peer behind the cards that everybody's holding. But there's always this tension between freedom and security. The more freedom you want, the less security you can have. The more security you want, the less freedom you can have. And it's a matter of trying to find a way to strike that balance.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, yesterday we had the president meeting with leaders of some of the U.S.-based global IT companies that worried about the economic impact of companies like Google.
Sure. And Google's already had issues in terms of what they do in China, in terms of allowing firewalls to go up. And I'm not an IT person, so I can't go very far with this. But, you know, how much do you accommodate a regime that's fairly dictatorial or limiting of individual freedom to gaze at and graze on the Internet? All these issues arise as we become increasingly globalized.
Let's turn our focus to one of the other big political stories of 2013. We have been talking about it for months, and we'll continue to talk about it as it has faded somewhat. But here is how The Atlantic Online put it, if I can read this, Dennis. How's this for a plan? Require citizens to purchase a product through a website that's down more than half the time, has epically slow page load times, and an astounding error rate. Oh, and a substantial portion of the back end of the site hasn't even been built. So who knows if your transaction has gone through when you're done. But hey, it's better than paying a fine, right? That was the lead of The Atlantic in, of course, talking about the rollout of these electronic marketplaces for the Affordable Care Act. And at this point, what can we say about what or who was to blame?
Well, you know, the buck stops with the president, and presidents can't know everything, but you've got to know what to be curious about. And if this is your signature issue, you want to make sure that this rolls out well. This raises serious questions about competence. Of course, it's a little bit of, there's a phrase, chutzpah, sort of cheek, Republicans complaining that this thing wasn't rolled out very well since they opposed the rollout to begin with. But nonetheless, it's a legitimate and valid attack to make on the administration because the incompetence with which this was rolled out was stunning when you put people in precisely the position reflected in the piece you just read. You add to that the issue of if you like your health care policy, you can keep it. That's been considered a lie on the part of the president.
In fact, if I can jump in here, Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post issued his 2013 list of the mm-hmm. biggest Pinocchios for the year. That was number one on the list, and it was said very many times by President Obama. Let's listen to a few of those times. As early as 2009, talking about the Affordable Care Act, here's the president.
You can keep your plan if you are satisfied with it.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
If you like your plan and you like your doctor, you won't have to do a thing. You keep your plan.
If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan.
If you've got health insurance, you can keep it.
If you like your health care plan, you will keep your plan.
If you've got health insurance, you like your doctor, you like your plan, you can keep your doctor. You can keep your
plan. Okay, we have about another minute of that. We don't need to listen to all those, Dennis Goldberg. We've documented it in fine shape there. Now, this was really a 1-2 punch for the Obama administration, wasn't it? The bad electronic rollout and then this what is being deemed as a lie for many people. But the administration has its own story about what they meant by this or what they now say they meant by this.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be charitable about it, it's a lie only if you knew it was not true when you said it. So if you say to me, what's 27 times 36, and I said 140, which it's not, I guess, you wouldn't say I'm lying. You would just say I'm mistaken. So if the president knew that this was not true when he said it, then yes, it's a lie. If he had been assured by people that this would indeed be possible, then he wasn't lying when he said it. He was simply mistaken or he was relying on false information that he didn't know to be false given him by other people. Either way, the buck stops with him. As you said, it's a 1-2 punch, the rollout and this particular issue. It's been really tough for them.
Mm-hmm. And I see in the latest new – this is a Quinnipiac poll from yesterday shows President Obama's approval rating hitting its lowest level ever in Iowa, nearly its worst rating of any state polled by Quinnipiac, just 38% approving of the job he is doing in the state of Iowa, among Iowans, I should say, 59% disapproving. So among independents, when we break that out a little bit, 62 disapproving, 31 approving. Among women, not quite as bad, 51 disapproving, 45 still in approval. Young people, I was wondering even if this was a typo. Maybe you can tell me, Dennis. Young people, 35% disapproval compared to still 62 in approval.
Yeah, he's had some erosion among support among young people. But, you know, a couple things in this regard. One is second terms are tough on all presidents. Johnson didn't run for a second term he could have after taking over when JFK was shot 50 years ago. But, you know, by the end of that first full term of his, which is the second term he was in office because of the assassination, you know, protesters were saying, Hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? You know, the whole Vietnam thing. Nixon's second term, Watergate. Carter didn't have a second term. Reagan's second term, the Iran-Contra scandal. Bush didn't have a second term. Clinton's second term, Lewinsky. President George W. Bush, second term, Hurricane Katrina, and then the eroding war in Iraq and so forth. Second terms have been tough. That being said, I think it was raising expectations falsely to talk about a possible honeymoon for President Obama after he won re-election. Typically, there's no honeymoon in a second term. The honeymoon occurs in the first term. A president normally has maybe 14, 16 months until members of Congress start to get interested in the first set of midterm elections in a new president's term. But President Obama's honeymoon in his first term lasted about 27 minutes by my counting. And by April of 2009, when the town hall meetings started occurring, he had lost control of the agenda at that point. And normally, When you're inclined to work with a victorious president, you're concerned that he's very popular, and if he campaigns against you, you may be defeated and so forth. Even Ronald Reagan couldn't hold his own Senate after a victorious re-election in 1984. In 86, he lost control of the Senate. He couldn't hold it. And if Republicans weren't inclined to support or work with President Obama in the first term, certainly once he was re-elected, you know, the moment he was re-elected and that was certified, he was a lame duck. And Republicans weren't going to be any more likely to work with him at that point than they were first term.
Late in 2013, in October, we had the government shutdown. A small group of House Republicans led this shutdown. They determined, this group was determined to either repeal, defund, delay Obamacare as a condition of funding the government. Senator Ted Cruz came to the fore there, made quite a profile for himself. House Speaker John Boehner going along with this. Why, Dennis?
Again, that's a case where you had the tail leading the dog. He could not control his caucus, the generic name for what's called formerly the House Republican Conference. He could not control the Republicans in the House. And sometimes, in a way, it was ridiculed when somebody for the Obama administration said President Obama was leading from behind, if you will. That was subject to a lot of ridicule. Well, in a way, John Boehner was leading from behind in the House. He had to work with people who couldn't get anything done on their own, but they could sabotage anything that Boehner and his folks wanted to get done. So he was just trying to make the best of a tough situation. As we said in the first half hour, we'll see where this goes. Now he's laid down a marker.
Mm-hmm. At midnight on October 1st, we had the federal agencies, the national parks, other services closing their doors. President Obama, Senate Majority Leader Reid, refusing to give in. And this gets then mixed up with the rollout of Obamacare electronically, because actually don't we see the president seeing a bump in popularity in not being seen as responsible for the government shutdown, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, the difficulties of the rollout eroded, if not exploded, that particular advantage that the Obama administration and the Democrats had out of negative reaction to the Republican shutdown. But yeah, a lot of Republicans recognized they wanted all the focus on Obamacare, on the Affordable Care Act and the rollout, but all the press and all the focus was on the shutdown that they had caused. So they were stepping on their own feet in that process.
Mm-hmm. Gridlock on Capitol Hill has been a complaint for the entire year, certainly a major story. What are the issues that didn't get addressed because of these issues that sidetracked us, the government shutdown being one of them?
Well, one, of course, that affects Iowa very much is the Farm Bill. And they've not worked that out because the Farm Bill, in order to garner the maximum support, has always bundled together two different, although related, issues. One, of course, is the issue of crop supports and crop insurance reports and supports and those sorts of things that we associate with a farm bill. The other has been food stamps. That has been bound up with the farm bill. Of course, it gives extra business to farmers, so it helps them in this regard. But it also helps the urban poor and working poor, and that's garnered support from urban legislators. So they bundled those two things together all those years to get support from two constituencies that might not normally work together. Well, they can't work this out now, and a lot of the Tea Party Republicans want to split out the food stamp, or what used to be called food stamp programs, and just vote on the farm bill. But the urban legislators won't go along with that. So that's one of the problems. Immigration reform, attempting to do that. We keep sort of trying to do something about that all the time. As you said at the top of the show, that was something that people thought would be dealt with, and it hasn't. It's just toxic for Republicans. And again, when they're in these districts, I mean, a 435 House districts for both parties combined, there may be real races in only 25 to 35 this time around. That's how gerrymandered or locked in a lot of those incumbents are. And for Republicans, they fear an attack from an even more conservative prospective candidate. So you see that with Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. So he's not inclined to do much of anything because he fears an attack from a candidate who's further on his right. So these sorts of things combined for particular political interest of the office holders themselves, this combines to issue in gridlock.
Mm-hmm. Just days ago, I wonder if this affects gridlock in any way. Significantly, we had the long talked about nuclear option, the rule change mm-hmm. in the Senate to require only a simple majority to close debate, approve nominations, except for the Supreme Court nominations. No longer 60 votes, now simple majority. What does that do to the equation?
Well, it really angers Republicans. But, of course, Republicans got to this point by asking for it in a way. I mean, they have more or less systematically attempted to prevent the functioning of the Obama administration. It's one thing to talk about nominees for the judicial branch. But when you talk about not being allowed to staff or making it very difficult to staff your own administration, I mean, they did win the election. You get certain prerogatives from winning an election, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. And, you know, it's as if the LSU Tigers, their coaches get to decide who will play for the Iowa Hawkeyes on the Outback Bowl. You know, we wouldn't allow that. But that's the way it's been working in Congress.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues let's touch on before the hour ends is the amazing year that it has been politically for gay rights. In June, we had the U.S. Supreme Court overturning the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act. Tell us, remind us what that was and the significance of it being overturned.
Right. It's still the states that determine who's married and who's not. But the Defense of Marriage Act was passed during the Clinton administration. And there are all sorts of federal benefits like Social Security and spousal benefits and so forth. The federal government has to decide who's eligible for these things. And what the Defense of Marriage Act basically did was say that for federal purposes in determining who's a spouse and who's not in various kinds of circumstances, same-sex couples would not count as spouses. And so that raised that particular issue. The court overturned that in a narrow vote, that particular statute, based on equal protection grounds. What they did not do, where they did not go, is determining whether there is in the Constitution a right to have same-sex marriage, the way the case of Loving versus Virginia in 1967 overturned anti-miscegenation statutes that prohibited whites and non-whites from marrying. The court said no, the Constitution forbids states from prohibiting those sorts of marriages. Well, they didn't reach the question of whether the Constitution prohibits states from prohibiting same-sex marriage. That'll be next on the agenda at some point. But for right now, if a given state allows for same-sex marriage, then the federal government will attempt to respect that state's judgment for the people in that state and give them things like spousal benefits.
Another part of the amazing year for gay rights has been at the start of the year, we had same-sex marriage legally sanctioned in 9 states, according to my research. Now 16 states sanctioned same-sex marriage by this year end. It remains barred by law in 33 states. And I think significantly, isn't it, Dennis, that 5 of the states accomplishing the change this year did it through their legislatures, not through a court decision, as Iowa's mm-hmm. was.
Well, you know, the people opposing same-sex marriage, and my concern is not to get into the merits of all that, but the politics of it and the constitutional law of it, you know, a lot of their argument was this is not to be something a court imposes. That was part of the reaction to the Varnum decision here in Iowa. The advertising said these justices impose their own agenda on the voters of Iowa. Well, whether that's the case or not, certainly if you're against same-sex marriage because a court's imposed it and you say it should be done by the people of the state, you don't have much of a leg to stand on if the people of your state actually vote in favor of same-sex marriage. Now, when you say that, what was your figure? How many states now allow it?
16, according to
16.
To my,
okay,
yes.
Mm-hmm. So
the thing was 5 of them. 5 of them changed it through legislature, the others through the courts.
Right. Now, remember, 16 states are still simply 32% of the states. In other words, 68% of the states, 2/3 of the states still prohibit it. Now, you could look in terms, and I've not done this, in terms of population. What's the total population of those 16 states as opposed to the population of the other 34 states there? Because, you know, the more rural, the more sparse the population, the more likely they are to oppose same-sex marriage. The more urban, the more likely they are to support same-sex marriage mm-hmm. rights. But that being said, you know, the question is whether the cultural shift decried by some, celebrated by others, is outrunning the actual legal and political process itself.
Okay, we've got to end this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University. Dennis, I dare say it'll be the last time in 2013 we get to hear your insights on our political landscape in the state and nationwide. Thank you very much for spending the hour with us.
Great fun flying solo.
Okay. Dennis Goldford, look forward to your insights in 2014, along with our other political experts from around the state. Going to go out with a little music. Let's see if you get the hidden political news in the lyrics of this Beach Boys tune as we go out. I want to thank our producers, Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay tuned tomorrow. Listen back to the event during this time tomorrow, the noon hour. NPR's Don Gagne live in Des Moines. Listen for it tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in. I've been on the thinking, but it's understood. I got a fuel injected engine sitting under my hood. Shut it off, buddy, now I shut you down. Shut it off, buddy, now I shut you down. Shut it off, buddy, now I shut you down.